In the last decade or so, I've noticed a subtle change in most of our city centres. These centres used to be full of American fast food joints, your KFCs, your McDonald's, your Hungry Jack's. But bit by bit, these American chains are slowly being pushed out of the CBD and they're being replaced by noodle bars and sushi joints and dumpling restaurants and curry houses. And by and large, the food is, quite frankly, fresher, tastier, and more nutritious. Our food choices are making our cities less like an offshoot of California and more like part of the region that we live in. I can guess that Adam Liao welcomes this transformation in Australian tastes. Adam is, of course, the guy who won MasterChef and has published many cookbooks and has also put to air several series on SBS. He was born in Malaysia, grew up in Australia, and then spent 9 years living in Japan. And all of these places have infused his cooking with the influences of a whole range of different Asian cuisines. Adam's got a new cookbook called Adam Liao's Asian Cookery School because he wants more of us to make this stuff for ourselves and be inspired by the underlying principles and philosophies, in fact, of Asian cuisines. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Have you noticed this change I'm talking about in our cities?
I have, absolutely. And I firmly believe that Australian food is defined by its Asianness, essentially. I have always thought that Australia has the best Asian food of anywhere in the world, and I don't mean that in terms of Western countries, I mean that in terms of any country.
Really? How does that work?
Well, including Asia. You know, if you go to Vietnam, we have far better Japanese restaurants in Australia than Vietnam does. And we have far better Thai restaurants here than you would find in Japan. And if you go to China, you'll get better Malaysian food in the Sydney CBD than you would anywhere in China. So, and of course, we have fantastic, authentic cuisines and food from these cuisines everywhere. And as a totality, I don't think you can really say any other country comes even close to Australia in terms of the overall quality of and variety of Asian food that we have.
Now, you were a lawyer when you went on MasterChef, not a chef as such. Where does this food education that you clearly had and you were able to bring to MasterChef, where does that come from, Adam?
I think it primarily comes from a love of eating. as most people start off doing, nobody gets into a kitchen without loving eating first. And growing up, I grew up in Adelaide and in Malaysia and various other places. And there's a food education that happens to a kid. And I remember going to the Chinese seafood restaurants, as they're called, where they've got the fish in the live tanks and you can watch them happening. And all of these little moments that teach you about food are really important. It builds your relationship with food as you get older. You know, I've eaten crispy skin chicken 1,000 times before I ever thought about cooking it myself, and now it's something that I do make relatively often.
Just before we go any further, what is the secret to good crispy skin chicken, by the way? Because I've never been able to make that. Do you have a kind of a secret to making it just right?
The secret is drying it. You know, to get that skin really crispy, the way I do it is I hang it up. I either tie some string under the wings and just hang it up either in front of a fan or anywhere that's a bit breezy, and you leave it for at least a good 4 hours, and then you see, and that's fine. Food safety wise, it is fine as long as you cook it then after that, and so you end up with the skin kind of gets a bit. It looks a bit thin and a bit dry, and that's what gives you the really good crisp.
Right, so you make it like parchment before you cook the thing as such.
Yeah.
You say in your book that there are five basic tastes as recognised in Asian cooking, and that is salty, sweet, sour, bitter, and the fifth one is called umami. What is umami?
Umami, yes, it's the, without being too grandiose about it, it's the secret to making food taste good. Those five tastes are the things that our taste buds taste, you know, very distinct from flavour and aroma and the smell of mint or the fragrance of rosemary.
Oh, this is not an Asian cuisine thing. This is a human thing.
This is a human thing. Okay. Umami is the human thing when it comes to food. You know, it's deliciousness is what umami translates to. It's a Japanese word, but it is a receptor on your tongue, a taste bud on your tongue, when a particular thing hits it, usually the amino acid glutamate or something like it, in the same way that sodium chloride hits your tongue and makes you taste salty, and glucose hits your tongue and makes it taste sweet, umami or amino acids hit your tongue and make things taste better. And it's a very useful thing, as you can imagine, for cooking to know how to make things taste better. But if you look at every cuisine in the world, umami is at the basis of it. And it's very common in fermented foods. It's very common in, say, Italian cuisine. Parmesan cheese is one of the highest sources of umami that we have, and so is tomatoes. And then you put parmesan cheese and tomatoes together, and all of a sudden you've got a cuisine. You go back to ancient Rome and the garum that they used to make from fermented fish, very similar to modern-day Thai fish sauce, is there for its umami properties. And actually, if you look at stocks the world over, the one thing that's common, whether it's chicken consomme from France or beef broth or demi-glace or ichiban dashi from Japan or anchovy stocks from Korea, they all have the same concentration of these umami molecules. And can you have a guess as to where that concentration may exist in nature?
I've got no idea. No.
Mother's milk, human breast milk.
Really?
So we are biologically programmed to find these things delicious. And that's the whole reason why we use stock, is to add flavor and to add deliciousness to our food. It's not, you don't add chicken stock to something to make your risotto tastes chickeny. You know, you make it taste better.
And does garlic hit that same place as well?
It doesn't. When you fry garlic, though, and this is the thing about umami, it's you can bring it out in ingredients, particularly. It's the reason why we grill a steak or fry a steak rather than boiling it, for example. When you reach those high temperatures, you have what's called Maillard reactions, a reaction, not to get too sort of chemistry about this or biology about it. It's this reaction between starches and proteins that gives you brown colors and good flavors in food. So that's why our fried steak or grilled steak tastes better than a boiled one.
So maybe the only kind of other word we'd have that was its equivalent is something like piquancy or something like that. It's an intensity that you get from Parmesan.
Brillat savour in the old French gourmand, I think is the correct term, used to call it osmosome. And so it's been this property in food that we have always known about, but it wasn't until probably the early 20th century, I think 1907, I think, that a Japanese chemist actually put a name to it, and he called it umami.
Now, you lived in Japan for all those years, as I said, and both you and I, as it turns out, are collectors of this manga called Oishinbo, which is actually a kind of an ongoing multi-volume cooking competition between a father and son, which happens over many years. And it kind of speaks to the Japanese obsessiveness about food, complete obsessiveness. And there seems to be all kinds of underlying philosophies behind Japanese food. Talk a bit about that, if you could, about the kind of some philosophical ideas that undergird Japanese food.
Well, I think Japanese cuisine kind of gets it right when it comes to it. I'm not saying everyone should eat Japanese food, but in terms of simplicity, you know, most Japanese families cook incredibly simply. A piece of grilled fish, some pickles on the side, and a bowl of rice is a perfect meal at any time of the day in Japan. In terms of respect and seasonality and all of these things that we have come to really embrace in modern culture in Australia, have been around in Japan for a very long time. The idea of eating just what's in season and controlling your portions to a point where more is not necessarily better, or more is more or less is more, etc. There's a really healthy relationship that Japanese people have to food, I think.
Simplicity. And a kind of restraint. A restraint. And when do you break those restraints and you have something a bit more of a feast? Are there kind of reasons for that and philosophies behind that do something a bit more exquisite and complicated?
I think that the pinnacle and kind of maybe perhaps the inspiration behind the modern-day degustation is a style of eating in Japan called kaiseki. And that is, if you looked at the rules and regulations and the interpretation that went into a kaiseki meal, it's, you know, something from the mountain. There's a particular type of course where it's something from the mountain offset with something from the sea. And you have a mountain ingredient prepared very simply and a sea ingredient juxtaposed on a tray, often on separate dishes, to kind of sum up the entire world in one course. And then you've got 10, maybe perhaps up to 13 courses in the traditional kaiseki menu.
All right, you can like something from each part of the earth.
So something, you have something steamed and then something fried and then something from the mountains, something from the sea, something from the land. So there might be just a particular grain or rice course there. And it's almost like painting this picture with food, this philosophical picture with food over the course of one meal. And of course, that's the very high end, but it exists all the way through Japanese culture, even even to a literal $5 bowl of ramen that you'll get, you'll see this kind of composition of ramen. And that's why the Japanese love ramen. It's not that they have a particular fondness for noodles, which they do, but you have this philosophy behind it, ramen noodles being a bowl of noodles in soup, but the soup tends to be made up of pork bones and chicken bones, and then certain types of seafood in there, and then there'll be a piece of grilled char siu on top with some noodles that are made from grains that are grown there. And so you start to get this picture. It's almost like ramen is almost this entire philosophical kaiseki menu in a $5 bowl that you can get, literally by ordering through a vending machine.
Yeah, my wife was born in Singapore, and so she lived in Australia most of her life, but she still adheres to some traditions. And Chinese New Year, she often makes this kind of raw fish salad. One I'm talking about?
Yes.
That's made up of like raw fish and a bunch of different ingredients. And there's a philosophy behind it about different ingredients reflecting different elements. And it seems very random and abstract, but it comes together in the most heavenly way. It's actually one of my very favorite dishes.
It takes some getting used to. It's called yisang.
Yeah.
And it's this mix of usually raw salmon, although I've made it with raw lobster. It depends on kind of how Ooh. Expensive and decadent you want to be. Usually pomelo or grapefruit. And a lot of fresh and crispy vegetables. Sometimes you have deep fried wonton skins and stuff on there as well. And the dressing is the strangest thing about it. It's this very sweet mix of kind of lime, and some people put plum sauce in there and sesame seeds and all this kind of thing. And you throw it all together in this huge plate of salad, and then every single person around the table sticks their chopsticks in and tosses it higher in the air, and the higher you toss it, the more good luck you have. And it's a really fun dish, usually eaten at Chup Gourmet, which is, I think, the 14th day of the Chinese New Year.
Yeah, it's insane. It's actually one of my favourite things in the whole wide world. Now, you were born in Malaysia, Adam, but you were quite young when you left, weren't you?
About 3 years old.
Yeah.
But like most new emigres, we would travel back to Malaysia at least once a year, probably for the first 14 years of my life, I would say. So we kept up a bit of a Malaysia connection while we were living here in the early years.
You grew up in Adelaide then. Were there many Asian languages spoken around, several Asian languages spoken around the house?
Yes. It's funny, my mother is English, so she would speak English to us and to my father. My father and his mother would speak Hainanese Chinese to each other. My grandmother would speak to my mother in Malay, because that was the most common language that they were fluent in. And then, sadly, at the end of it all, we kind of came out the end only speaking English. And I speak Chinese and Japanese now, but it would have been much better to learn it from the early years rather than having to go and study it later in life like I had to.
After your parents split up, you were brought into a mixed family with a few more kids. How were your mealtimes spent in this kind of large mixed family?
Well, it was big. We had oftentimes seven kids around the table plus parents, and so it was sort of a blend of different families but also of cultures as well. So just say mum was cooking beef that night, it was not always just one thing of beef, because frankly there were not pots big enough that could fit on a stove that would fit everything in there. So it tended to be kind of half Asian, half Western, and I loved that part of my upbringing. If it was beef night, you would have beef and oyster sauce or beef and broccoli on one side of the table, and then beef stroganoff on the other side, and then they'd switch around halfway through the meal, and so you have this real mix of Asian foods and Western foods. It was curried lamb chops on one half in a very Malaysian style lamb curry, and then grilled lamb chops on the Western half of the table, and then we'd switch over, and it was multiculturalism on a family dinner table.
Well, that's the kind of philosophy of the Spice Islands anyway, isn't it, from Malaysia? You take a bit of this, you take a bit of that, you see what works. Indian spices, Chinese food, English ingredients here and there, throw it all together and make a kind of glorious hybrid.
Very, very much so. That part of the world, you've got the colonial influence, you've got Chinese migration, you've got the spice trade, and going back centuries and centuries. So there are some amazing foods that come out of Southeast Asia, the Nonya cuisines and those kind of things have such a long history to them.
You lived with your grandmother for a while. How important was she on your approach to cooking and food, Adam?
Very important. And I say that not just in terms of the nuts and bolts of kind of how do you cook, because I think that learning to cook is much less about the recipes. It's not so often that you're in the kitchen with whoever your mentor might be it a mother or a grandmother, and they're telling you, well, it's one teaspoon of this and a tablespoon of that. It's not so much that. It's this kind of ongoing relationship. And there's the little tips that they'll give about, you know, when does the wok look right to put something into it, or at what point does the dough, when you're making a dumpling, is it at the right point? It's very difficult to write that in a recipe unless you're writing a specific, specifically to that point. But then there's also the broader relationship about it. You know, is food to you a quick meal that you're going to make on a Tuesday night, or is it a way that you demonstrate your family togetherness, and is it a way that you show that it's a special occasion that you make something that, you know, maybe takes a little bit of effort, more effort, and but you're going to put that effort in because it's someone that you love and you want to share that experience with them? Or is it, you know, is a birthday where you're going to cook something at home that brings the whole family together, or are you going to go out to a nice restaurant? I'm not saying that one approach is better than the other, but it's all part of a relationship with food that starts from a very early age.
How long did it take you to learn to cook the way she cooked?
Not too long. You know, there were some fundamental missteps earlier. And this was, the thing was, my grandmother's food tasted uniformly amazing from when I was a very young boy. And I thought that there was some trick or some fancy thing that she was doing to make it taste so good. And I kept, you know, with this more is more approach. And I was like, well, I haven't got as much flavor as I can into this food, so I'm missing something. And I take all the sauces out of the cupboard and put every single one into them and try and find this magical combination of things. But fundamentally, at the end of it all, I realized, I was probably about sort of 16 or 17 when I started to come to the realization that what she was doing was just treating the food very simply. And so my big thing about stir fries is, when a lot of people make stir fries both at home and or out in a not particularly good takeaway, is they tend to be defined by the flavor of all the sauces that are added into it. When my grandma made a stir fry, if it was beef and broccoli, it tasted like beef and it tasted like broccoli. It didn't taste like oyster sauce or satay sauce or some concoction that was poured over the top of it. It was all about, and I think this is the real key to Asian cooking, extracting the natural flavor of the ingredients you're using.
Did the food she cooked reflect the tough life she had led before she came to Australia?
It did. What did she experience
while during the war years, for example?
She experienced some terrible things. You know, her sister was murdered right in front of her eyes at a cafe that they ran. She was terribly poor for a large portion of her life. You know, her husband died when she was probably 25, leaving her to raise three kids alone. So it was not a particularly easy time for her, but she won a fairly modest sum in a lottery, which gave them enough kind of funds to send her kids to school and for her to continue working, rather than having to pull the kids out of school and send them to work to keep the family alive. And then, you know, fast forward 60-odd years later, and her kids are doctors and engineers, and her grandkids are, well, except for the exception of the one guy who's talking to you on the radio now who writes cookbooks, they're all doctors as well.
Yes, but you were a lawyer.
I was a lawyer, but a failed lawyer like many others.
Well, you didn't want such a failed lawyer. You kind of gave it away. You had a job for a while with Tokyo Disney. That sounds pretty good. I don't know if I want a lawyer with Tokyo Disney. I don't know what that would be like. But I don't know. Was that fun for a while?
It was fantastic. Yeah. It really was. You know, my connection with Japan before I moved there was next to zero. You know, I couldn't speak a word of the language, had no real interest in it. I was looking to further my career in the law and took the best job that I'd ever been offered to move over there and work with Disney there. And it was a real learning experience, both professionally and personally, and ultimately it really affected the way and infected the way that I think about food and cooking.
Is this where you met your wife in Tokyo?
Yes. Yeah, we worked for the same company. She was an ex-producer at Disney herself.
Did you have a kind of life plan for how your life was going to play out as a lawyer in Tokyo?
Yeah, I think so. I never thought I was going to stay in Tokyo full time, but when you're in an office job, I guess, the path forward becomes very clear. You start to see where maybe you might not be going, but where you want to go in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years. And that was probably one of the motivations for me entering MasterChef in the first place. Not that I was unhappy with the trajectory my life was going, quite the contrary, I was pretty ecstatic about it. But going through school, straight into university, I think my gap after university before starting my first legal job was a day and a half, I think, you know. So I'd never really taken a break. I'd been trying to fast track my life all the way through, and then I hit the age of 29, 30, and I was like, okay, well, why don't I step off the treadmill just for a couple of months, see how things go, and yeah, here we are, 6 or 7 years later.
You win MasterChef. Yeah. How was that like for you, that process of being part of MasterChef? Well, the thing that most people don't see about the TV process is, by and large, making it is actually really boring.
Incredibly boring.
Incredibly boring. It's a lot of hanging around while the lighting guy gets something sorted, and they have to deal with all that, and that has to be part of it. How did you find that process?
A welcome change, to be honest. You know, I really liked the aspect, as a reality TV contestant, one of the things you have to come to terms with is a complete loss of liberty. You know, you're stuck in a shipping container to sit on an upturned crate for 7 hours with no phone and no internet access and no email. And it sounds like deprivation, but actually when you, these days, I think a lot of people can feel overwhelmed by the pressure to respond to an email within 5 minutes of receiving it, or return every single phone call within an hour of a message being left, and you kind of feel a bit assaulted by modern life at times. And there's not too many ways that you can escape for that. For the length of time that I did when I was filming MasterChef, it took us nearly 11 months of filming with no contact with all of that, and it was almost, it was like a very long...
Like joining the Moonies, was it?
Yeah, a little bit like that, but without having to, you know,
George
give up
Calamaris
all your possessions and that kind of thing.
You almost thought about pulling out at one point, didn't you?
No, many points.
What changed your mind?
Well, it was a farcical thing to do, if I'm going to be entirely honest with myself. It was this idea of giving up a very successful and a job that I've been trying to have and do well in for my entire career, to go on a reality TV show in a country that I didn't live in, to hopefully at the end of it win a fraction of my annual salary and prize money. So it didn't make a lot of sense, but there was a point where I realized that putting it all down on paper, the sums would never add up and it would never make sense, but it just felt right. So it was definitely a gut choice rather than a head choice.
And then going from stepping out of, you know, MasterChef, you know, that colony that was MasterChef, essentially the studio, and then out into the big wide world where you're suddenly one of the most famous people in the country. That's got to be very strange and discombobulating once you...
Very strange. Very, very odd. Because I'd been living in Japan for the first series of MasterChef, I hadn't seen any of it, and I hadn't seen particularly the reaction in society to it, which then was amplified in the second season. And as I said, we were isolated from most of society for the majority of the filming time, so we didn't know what we were stepping out into. And then there was this
complete loss of privacy, I'm sure. That's very odd.
Yeah, but you get used to it.
You've got a son now, a young son. Is he old enough to appreciate what you make for him, or how's he going with all that?
He eats well. He eats very well. He has a very varied diet. We cook pretty much everything that he eats, and he understands food well enough now to be able to request things, and he wants noodles in the morning, and luckily we're able to accommodate that to a certain extent. You know, I don't want to spoil him, but it's nice to know that he enjoys food.
It's been really great to speak with you, Adam, and fantastic to have this chat and to talk with you about the glories of Asian food. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to have this chat.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.